material of the adger were handed from one to another. Before this was carried a testudo 60 feet long for leveling the ground, made also of very strong timber, and covered over with everything that was capable of protecting it against the fire and stones thrown by the enemy. But the greatness of the works, the height of the wall and towers, and the multitude of engines slowed the progress of our works. Besides, frequent sallies were made from the town by the Albici, and fire was thrown on our mound and turrets. These our men easily repulsed, and doing considerable damage to those who sallied, they beat them back into the town. In the meantime, Lucius Nasidius, being sent by Cneius Pompey, with a fleet of 16 sail, a few of which had beaks of brass, to the assistance of Lucius Domitius and the Massilians, passed the straits of Sicily without the knowledge or expectation of Curio, and putting his fleet into Messana, and making the nobles and senate take flight with a sudden terror, carried off one of their ships out of dock. Having joined this to his other ships, he made good his voyage to Massilia, and having sent in a galley privately, acquainted Domitius and the Massilians of his arrival, and earnestly encouraged them to hazard another battle with Brutus's fleet, with the addition of his aid. The Massilians, since their former loss, had brought the same number of old ships from the docks, and had repaired and fitted them out with great industry. They had a large supply of seamen and pilots. They had got several fishing smacks, and covered them over, so the seamen might be secure against dart fire. These they filled with archers and engines. With a fleet thus appointed, encouraged by the entreaties and tears of all the old men, matrons, and virgins, to succor the state in this hour of distress, they went on board with no less spirit and confidence than they had fought before. For it happens, from a common infirmity of human nature, that we are more flushed with confidence, or more vehemently alarmed at things unseen, concealed, and unknown, as was the case then. For the arrival of Lucius Nasidius had filled this state with the most sanguine hopes and wishes. Having got a fair wind, they sailed out of port, and went to Nasidius and Tauroes, which is a fort belonging to the Massilians, and there ranged their fleet and again encouraged each other to engage and communicated their plan of operation. The command of the right division was given to the Massilians, that of the left to Nasidius. Brutus sailed to the same place with an augmented fleet. For to those made by me at Arelas were added 6 ships, taken from the Massilians, which he had refitted since the last battle and had furnished with every necessity. Accordingly, having encouraged his men to despise the vanquished people who they had conquered when yet unbroken, he advanced against them full of confidence and spirit. From Trebonius's camp and all the higher grounds it was easy to see into the town, how all the youth which remained in it, and all people of more advanced years with their wives and children, and the public guards, were either extending their hands from the wall to the heavens, or were repairing to the temples of the immortal gods, and prostrating themselves before their images, were entreating them to grant them victory. Nor was there a single person who did not imagine that his future fortune depended on the issue of that day, for the choice of their youth and the most respectable of every age, being expressly invited and solicited, had gone on board the fleet, that if any adverse fate should befall them, they might see that nothing was left for them to attempt, and if they proved victorious, they might have hopes of preserving the city, either by their internal resources or by foreign assistance. When the battle was begun, no effort of valor was lacking to the Massilians, but mindful of the instructions which they had a little before received from their friends, they fought with such spirit as if they supposed that they would never have another opportunity to attempt a defense, and as if they believed that those whose lives should be endangered in the battle would not long precede the fate of the rest of the citizens, who, if the city was taken, must undergo the same fortune of war. Our ships being at some distance from each other, Room was allowed both for the skill of their pilots and the maneuvering of their ships, and if at any time ours, gaining an advantage by casting the iron hooks on board their ships, grappled with them, from all parts they assisted those who were distressed. Nor, after being joined by the Albici, did they decline coming to close engagement, nor were they much inferior to our men in valor. At the same time, showers of darts, thrown from a distance from the lesser ships, suddenly inflicted several wounds on our men when off their guard and otherwise engaged, and two of their three-decked galleys, having sighted the ship of Decimus Brutus, which could be easily distinguished by its flag, rowed up against him with great violence from opposite sides. But Brutus, seeing into their designs, by the swiftness of his ship extricated himself with such address as to get clear, though only by a moment. From the velocity of their motion they struck against each other with such violence that they were both excessively injured by the shock. The beak, indeed, of one of them being broken off, the whole ship was ready to sink, which circumstance being observed, the ships of Brutus's fleet, which were nearest that station, attacked them when in this disorder, and sank them both. But Nasidius's ships were of no use, and soon left the fight, for the sight of their country or the entreaties of their relations did not urge them to run a desperate risk of their lives. Therefore, of the number of the ships, not one was lost. Of the fleet of the Massilians, five were sunk, four taken, and one ran off with Nasidius. Everyone that escaped made the best of their way to hither Spain, but one of the rest was sent forward to Massilia for the purpose of bearing this intelligence. And when it came near the city, the whole people crowded out to hear the tidings, and on being informed of the event were so oppressed with grief that one would have imagined that the city had been taken by an enemy at the same moment. The Massilians, however, began to make the necessary preparations for the defense of their city with unwearied energy. The legionary soldiers who had the management of the works on the right side observed from the frequent sallies of the enemy that it might prove a great protection to them to build a turret of brick under the wall for a fort and place of refuge, which they at first built low and small to guard them against sudden attacks. To it they retreated, and from it they made defense if any superior force attacked them, and from it they sallied out either to repel or pursue the enemy. It extended 30 feet on every side, and the thickness of the walls was 5 feet. But afterward, as experience is the best master in everything on which the wit of man is employed, it was found that it might be of considerable service if it was raised to the usual height of turrets, which was effected in the following manner. When the turret was raised to the height for flooring, they laid it on the walls in such a manner that the ends of the joists were covered by the outer face of the wall, that nothing should project to which the enemy's fire might adhere. They moreover built over the joists with small bricks as high as the protection of the plutii and veniae permitted them. And on that place they laid 2 beams across, angleways at a small distance from the outer walls, to support the rafters which were to cover the turret. And on the beams they laid joists across in a direct line, and on these they fastened down planks. These joists they made somewhat longer to project beyond the outside of the wall, that they might serve to hang a curtain on them to defend and repel all blows, while they were building the walls between that and the next floor. And the floor of this story they faced with bricks and mortar, that the enemy's fire might do them no damage, and on this they spread mattresses, lest the weapons thrown from engines should break through the flooring, or stones from catapults should batter the brickwork. They moreover made 3 mats of cable ropes, each of them the length of the turret walls, and 4 feet broad, and hanging them round the turret on the 3 sides which faced the enemy, fastened them to the projecting hoists. For this was the only sort of defense which, they had learned by experience in other places, could not be pierced by darts or engines. But when that part of the turret was completed, and was protected and secured against every attempt of the enemy, they removed the Plutii to other works. They began to suspend gradually, and raise by screws from the first floor the entire roof of the turret, and then they elevated it as high as the length of the mats allowed. Hid and secured within these coverings, they built up the walls with bricks, and again, by another turn of the screw, cleared a place for themselves to proceed with the building. And when they thought it time to lay another floor, they laid the ends of the beams, covered in by the outer bricks in like manner as in the first story, and from that story they again raised the uppermost floor and the mat work. In this manner, securely and without a blow or danger, they raised it 6 stories high, and in laying the materials left loopholes in such places as they thought proper for working their engines. When they were confident that they could protect the works, they resolved to build a musculus, 60 feet long, of timber, 2 feet square, and to extend it from the brick tower to the enemy's tower and wall. This was the form of it. First, 2 beams of equal length were laid on the ground, at the distance of 4 feet from each other, and in them were fastened small pillars, 5 feet high, which were joined together by braces with a gentle slope, on which the timber which they must place to support the roof of the musculus should be laid. Upon this were laid beams 2 feet square, bound with iron plates and nails. To the upper covering of the musculus and the upper beams they fastened laths, 4 fingers square, to support the tiles which were to cover the musculus. The roof being thus sloped and laid over in rows in the same manner as the joists were laid on the braces, the musculus was covered with tiles and mortar, to secure it against fire, which might be thrown from the wall. Over the tiles, hides are spread, to prevent the water let in on them by spouts from dissolving the cement of the bricks. Again, the hides were covered over with mattresses, that they might not be destroyed by fire or stones. The soldiers, under the protection of the Veniae, finished this whole work to the very tower, and suddenly, before the enemy were aware of it, moved it forward by naval machinery, by putting rollers under it, close up to the enemy's turret, so that it even touched the building. The townsmen, frightened by this unexpected stroke, brought forward with levers the largest stones they could procure, and pitching them from the wall, rolled them down on the musculus. The strength of the timber withstood the shock, and whatever fell on slid off, on account of the sloping roof. When they perceived this, they altered their plan and set fire to barrels, filled with resin and tar, and rolled them down from the wall on the musculus. As soon as they fell on it, they slid off again, and were removed from its side by long poles and forks. In the meantime, the soldiers under cover of the musculus were rooting out with crowbars the lowest stones of the enemy's turret, with which the foundation was laid. The musculus was defended by darts thrown from engines by our men from the brick tower, and the enemy were beaten off from the wall and turrets. Nor was a fair opportunity of defending the walls given them. At length, several stones being picked away from the foundation of that turret beside the musculus, part of it fell down suddenly, and the rest, as if following it, leaned forward. At this point, the enemy, distressed at the sudden fall of the turret, surprised at the unforeseen calamity, awed by the wrath of the gods, and dreading the pillage of their city, rushed altogether out of the gate unharmed, with their temples bound with fillets, and suppliantly stretched out their hands to the officers and the army. At this uncommon occurrence, the whole progress of the war was stopped, and the soldiers, turning away from the battle, ran eagerly to hear and listen to them. When the enemy came up to the commanders and the army, they all fell down at their feet, and beseeched them to wait until my arrival. They saw that their city was taken, our works complete, and their tower undermined. Therefore they desisted from a defense, that no obstacle could arise to prevent their being instantly plundered at a beck, as soon as I arrived, if they refused to submit to my orders. They informed them that if the turret had entirely fallen down, the soldiers could not be withheld from forcing into the town and sacking it in hopes of getting spoil. These and several other arguments to the same effect were delivered, as they were a people of great learning, with great pathos and lamentations. The lieutenants, moved with compassion, drew off the soldiers from the work, desisted from the assault, and left sentinels on the works. A sort of truce having been made through compassion for the besieged, my arrival was anxiously awaited. Not a dart was thrown from the walls or by our men, but all remitted their care and diligence, as if the business was at an end. I had given Trebonius strict charge not to suffer the town to be taken by storm, lest the soldiers, too much irritated by both abhorrence of their revolt, by the contempt shown to them, and by their long labor, should put to the sword all the grown-up inhabitants, as they threatened to do. And it was with difficulty that they were then restrained from breaking into the town, and they were much displeased, because they imagined that they were prevented by Trebonius from taking possession of it. But the enemy, destitute of all honor, only waited for a time and opportunity for fraud and treachery. And after an interval of some days, when our men were careless and negligent, suddenly at noon, when some were dispersed and others indulging themselves in rest on the very works after the fatigue of the day, their arms all laid by and covered up, they sallied out from the gates. The wind being high and favorable to them, they set fire to our works, and the wind spread it in such a manner that in the same instant the Adger, Plutii, Testudo, tower, and engines all caught the flames, and were consumed before we could conceive how it had occurred. Our men, alarmed at such an unexpected turn of fortune, lay hold on such arms as they could find. Some rushed from the camp. An attack was made on the enemy, but they were prevented by arrows and engines from the walls from pursuing them when they fled. They retired to their walls, and there, without fear, set the Musculus and brick tower on fire. Thus, by the perfidy of the enemy and the violence of the storm, the labor of many months was destroyed in a moment. The Massilians made the same attempt the next day, having got just such another storm. They sallied out against the other tower and Adger, and fought with more confidence. But as our men had on the former occasion given up all thoughts of a contest, so, warned by the event of the preceding day, they had made every preparation for a defense. Accordingly, they slew several, and forced the rest to retreat into the town without affecting their plan. Trebonius began to provide and repair what had been destroyed, with much greater zeal on the part of the soldiers. For when they saw that their extraordinary pains and preparations had an unfortunate result, they were fired with indignation, that in consequence of the impious violation of the truce, their valor should be held in derision. There was no place left from which the materials for their mound could be fetched, in consequence of all the timber far and wide in the territories of the Massilians having been cut down and carried away. They began therefore to make an adger of a new construction, never heard of before, of two walls of brick, each 6 feet thick, and to lay floors over them of almost the same breadth with the adger made of timber. But wherever the space between the walls or the weakness of the timber seemed to require it, pillars were placed underneath and traversed beams laid on to strengthen the work, and the space which was floored was covered over with hurdles, and the hurdles plastered over with mortar. The soldiers covered overhead by the floor, on the right and left by the wall, and in the front by the mantlets, carried whatever materials were necessary for the building without danger. The business was soon finished. The loss of their laborious work was soon repaired by the dexterity and fortitude of the soldiers. Gates for making sallies were left in the wall in such places as they thought proper. But when the enemy perceived that those works which they had hoped could not be replaced without a great length of time were put into so thorough repair by a few days' labor and diligence that there was no room for perfidy or sallies, and that no means were left them by which they could either hurt the men by resistance or the works by fire. And when they found by former examples that their town could be surrounded with a wall and turrets on every part by which it was accessible by land, in such a manner that they could not have room to stand on their own fortifications, because our works were built almost on the top of their walls by our army, and darts could be thrown from our hands. And when they perceived that all advantage arising from their engines, on which they had built great hopes, was totally lost, and that though they had an opportunity of fighting with us on equal terms from walls and turrets, they could perceive that they were not equal to our men in bravery, they had recourse to the same proposals of surrender as before. In further Spain, Marcus Varro, in the beginning of the disturbances, when he heard of the circumstances which took place in Italy, being diffident of Pompey's success, used to speak of me in a very friendly manner. Though being pre-engaged to Cneius Pompey in quality of lieutenant, he was bound in honor to him. Nevertheless, there existed a very intimate tie between he and I. He was not ignorant of the duty of a lieutenant, who bore an office of trust, nor of his own strength, nor of the disposition of the whole province to me. These sentiments he constantly expressed in his ordinary conversation, and did not attach himself to either party. But afterward, when he found that I was detained before Massilia, that the forces of Petreius had effected a junction with the army of Afranius, that considerable reinforcements had come to their assistance, that there were great hopes and expectations, and heard that the whole hither province had entered into a confederacy, and of the difficulties to which I was reduced afterward at Ilerda for lack of provisions, and Afranius wrote to him a fuller and more exaggerated account of these matters, he began to regulate his movements by those of fortune. He made levies throughout the province, and having completed his two legions, he added to them about 30 auxiliary cohorts. He collected a large quantity of corn to send partly to the Massilians, partly to Afranius and Petreius. He commanded the inhabitants of Gades to build 10 ships of war. In addition, he took care that several others should be built in Spain. He removed all the money and ornaments from the Temple of Hercules to the town of Gades, and sent 6 cohorts there from the province to guard them, and gave the command of the town of Gades to Caius Scalonius, a Roman knight and friend of Domitius, who had come there sent by Domitius to recover an estate for him, and he deposited all the arms, both public and private, in Galonius's house. Varro made severe harangues against me. He often pronounced from his tribunal that I had fought several unsuccessful battles, and that a great number of my men had deserted to Afranius, that he had these accounts from undoubted messengers and authority on which he could rely. By these means he terrified the Roman citizens of that province, and obliged them to promise him for the service of the state 190,000 sesterces, 20,000 pounds weight of silver, and 120,000 bushels of wheat. He laid heavier burdens on those states which he thought were friendly with me, and billeted troops on them. He passed judgment against some private people, and condemned to confiscation the properties of those who had spoken or made orations against the Republic, and forced the whole province to take an oath of allegiance to him and Pompey. Being informed of all that happened in hither Spain, he prepared for war. This was his plan of operations. He was to retire with his 2 legions to Gades, and to lay up all the shipping and provisions there, for he had been informed that the whole province was inclined to favor my party. He thought that the war might be easily protracted in an island, if he was provided with corn and shipping. Although I was called back to Italy by many important matters, yet had determined to leave no dregs of war behind in Spain, because it was known that Pompey had many dependents and clients in the hither province. Having therefore sent 2 legions into further Spain under the command of Quintus Cassius, tribune of the people, he himself advanced with 600 horse by forced marches, and issued a proclamation appointing a day on which the magistrates and nobility of all the states should attend him at Corduba. This proclamation being published through the whole province, there was not a state that did not send a part of their senate to Corduba at the appointed time, and not a Roman citizen of any note did not appear that day. At the same time, the senate at Corduba shut the gates of their own accord against Varro, and posted guards and sentinels on the wall and in the turrets, and detained two cohorts, called Colonicae, which had come there accidentally, for the defense of the town. About the same time the people of Carmona, which is by far the strongest state in the whole province, by themselves drove out of the town the cohorts and shut the gates against them, although three cohorts had been detached by Varro to garrison the citadel. But Varro was in greater haste on this account to reach Gades with his legion as soon as possible, lest he should be stopped either on his march or on crossing over to the island. The affection of the province for me proved so great and so favorable that I received a letter from Gades before I was far advanced on the march, that as soon as the nobility of Gades heard of my proclamation, they had combined with the tribune of the cohorts, which were in garrison there, to drive Gallonius out of the town, and to secure the city and island for me, that, having agreed on the design, they had sent notice to Gallonius to quit Gades of his own accord, while he could do it with safety. If he did not, they would take measures for themselves, that, for fear of this, Gallonius had been induced to quit the town. When this was known, one of Varro's two legions, which was called Vernacula, carried off the colors from Varro's camp, he himself standing by and looking on, and retired to Hispalis, and took post in the market and public places without doing any injury. The Roman citizens living there approved so highly of this act that everyone most earnestly offered to entertain them in their houses. When Varro, terrified at these things, having altered his route, proposed going to Italica, he was informed by his friends that the gates were shut against him. Then indeed, when intercepted from every road, he sent word to me that he was ready to deliver up the legion which he commanded. I sent to him Sextus Caesar, and ordered him to deliver it up to me. Varro, having delivered up the legion, came to me in Corduba, and having laid before me the public accounts, handed over to me most faithfully whatever money he had, and told me what quantity of corn and shipping he had, and where it was. I made a public oration at Corduba, in which I returned thanks to all separately, to the Roman citizens, because they had been zealous to keep the town in their own power, to the Spaniards for having driven out the garrison, to the Gaditani for having defeated the attempts of my enemies, and I asserted their own liberty, to the tribunes and centurions who had gone there as a guard, for having by their valor confirmed them in their purpose. I remitted the tax which the Roman citizens had promised to Varro for the public use. I restored their goods to those who I was informed had incurred that penalty by speaking too freely. Having given public and private rewards to some, I filled the rest with flattering hopes of my future intentions. Having stayed 2 days at Corduba, I set out for Gades. I ordered the money and ornaments which had been carried away from the Temple of Hercules, and lodged in the houses of private persons, be replaced in the temple. I made Quintus Cassius governor of the province, and assigned him 4 legions. With those ships which Marcus Varro had built, and others which the Gaditani had built by Varro's orders, I arrived in a few days at Tarraco, where ambassadors from the greatest part of the nearer province awaited my arrival. Having in the same manner conferred marks of honor both publicly and privately on some states, I left Tarraco, and went from there by land to Narbo, and from there to Massilia. There I was informed that a law was passed for creating a dictator, and that I had been nominated dictator by Marcus Lepidus, the praetor. The Massilians, worn out by misfortunes of every sort, reduced to the lowest ebb for lack of corn, conquered in 2 engagements at sea, defeated in their frequent sallies, and struggling moreover with a fatal pestilence from their long confinement and change of victuals, for they all subsided on old millet and damaged barley, which they had formerly provided and laid up in the public storage against an emergency of this kind, their turret being demolished, a great part of their wall having given way, and despairing of any aid, either from the provinces or their armies, for these they had heard had fallen into my power, resolved to surrender now without dissimulation. But a few days before, Lucius Domitius, having discovered the intention of the Massilians, and having procured 3 ships, 2 of which he gave up to his friends, went on board the 3rd himself, having got a brisk wind, and put out to sea. Some ships, which by Brutus's orders were constantly cruising near the port, having sighted him, weighed anchor and pursued him. But of these the ship he was on board persevered itself, and continuing its flight, and by the aid of the wind got out of sight. The other 2, affrighted by the approach of our galleys, put back again into the harbor. The Massilians conveyed their arms and engines out of the town as they were ordered. They brought their ships out of the port and docks, and delivered up the money in their treasury. When these affairs were dispatched, I spared the town more out of regard to their renown and antiquity than to any claim they could lay to my favor, and left 2 legions in garrison there, sending the rest to Italy. I then set out for Rome. About the same time, Caius Curio, having sailed from Sicily to Africa, and from the first despising the forces of Publius Attius Varus, transported only 2 of the 4 legions which he had received from me, and 500 horse, and having spent 2 days and 3 nights on a voyage, arrived at a place called Aquilaria, which is about 22 miles distant from Clupea, and in the summer season had a convenient harbor, and was enclosed by 2 projecting promontories. Lucius Caesar, the son, who was awaiting his arrival near Clupea with 10 ships which had been taken near Utica in a war with the pirates, and which Publius Attius had had repaired for this war, frightened at the number of Curio's ships, fled the sea. Running his 3-decked covered galley on the nearest shore, he left her there, and made his escape by land to Adrumetum. Caius Considius Longus, with a garrison of 1 legion, guarded this town. The rest of Lucius Caesar's fleet, after this flight, retired to Adrumetum. Marcus Rufus, the quaestor, pursued him with 12 ships, which Curio had brought from Sicily as convoy to the merchantmen, and seeing a ship left on the shore, he brought her off by a towing rope, and returned with his fleet to Curio. Curio detached Marcus before with the fleet to Utica, and marched there with his army. Having advanced 2 days, he came to the river Bagrada, and there left Caius Caninius Rebilus, the lieutenant, with the legions, and went forward himself with the horse to view the Cornelian camp, because that was figured a very eligible position for encampment. It was a straight ridge, projecting into the sea, steep and rough on both sides, but the ascent was more gentle on that part which lies opposite Utica. It is not more than 1 mile distant from Utica in a direct line, but on this road there was a spring to which the sea came up and overflowed. An extensive morass was thereby formed, and if a person wanted to avoid it, he had to make a circuit of 6 miles to reach the town. Having examined this place, Curio got a view of Varus's camp, joining the wall and town at the gate called Bellica, well fortified by its natural situation, on one side by the town itself, on the other by a theater, which was in front of the town, the approaches to the town being rendered difficult and narrow by the very extensive outbuildings of that structure. At the same time he observed the roads very full of carriages and cattle, which they were conveying from the country into the town on the sudden alarm. He sent his cavalry after them to plunder them and get the spoil. At the same time Varus had detached as a guard for them 600 Numidian horse and 400 foot, which King Juba had sent to Utica as auxiliaries a few days before. There was a friendship subsisting between Juba's father and Pompey, and a feud between him and Curio, because he, when a tribune of the people, had proposed a law in which he endeavored to make public property the kingdom of Juba. The horse engaged, but the Numidians were not able to stand our first charge. 120 being killed, the rest retreated into their camp near the town. Meanwhile, on the arrival of his men of war, Curio ordered proclamation to be made to the merchant ships, which lay at anchor before Utica, in number about 200, that he would treat as enemies all that did not set sail immediately for the Cornelian camp. As soon as the proclamation was made, in an instant they all weighed anchor and left Utica, and repaired to the place commanded them. This circumstance furnished the army with plenty of everything. After these transactions, Curio returned to his camp at Bagrada, and by a general shout of the whole army was saluted Imperator. The next day he led his army to Utica, and encamped near the town. Before the works of the camp were finished, the horse upon guard brought him word that a large supply of horse and foot sent by King Juba were on their march to Utica, and at the same time a cloud of dust was observed, and in a moment the front of the line was in sight. Curio was surprised at the suddenness of the affair. He sent on the horse to receive their first charge and detain them. He immediately called off his legions from the work and put them in battle array. The horse began the battle, and before the legions could be completely marshaled and take their ground, the king's entire forces being thrown into disorder and confusion because they had marched without any order and were under no apprehensions, took themselves to flight. Almost all the enemy's horse being safe, because they made a speedy retreat into the town along the shore, our soldiers slew a great number of their infantry. The next night, 2 Marsian centurions with 22 men belonging to the companies deserted from Curio's camp to Attius Varus. They, whether they uttered the sentiments which they really entertained, or wished to gratify Varus, for what we wish we readily give credit to, and what we think ourselves, we hope is the opinion of other men, assured him that the minds of the whole army were disaffected to Curio, that it was very expedient that the armies should be brought in view of each other, and an opportunity of a conference be given. Induced by their opinion, Varus the next day led his troops out of the camp. Curio did so in like manner, and with only one small valley between them, each drew up his forces. In Varus's army there was one Sextus Quintilius Varus, who, as we've mentioned before, was at Corfinium. When I gave him his freedom, he went over to Africa. Curio had since transported to Africa those legions which I had received under his command a short time before at Corfinium, so the officers and companies were still the same, except for the change of a few centurions. Quintilius, making this a pretext for addressing them, began to go round Curio's lines and entreat the soldiers not to lose all recollection of the oath which they took first to Domitius, and to him their quaestor, nor to bear arms against those who had shared the same fortune, and endured the same hardships in a siege, nor fight for those by whom they had been opprobriously called deserters. To this he added a few words by way of encouragement, which they might expect from his own liberality, if they should follow him and Attius. On the delivery of this speech, no intimation of their future conduct was given by Curio's army, and thus both generals led back their troops to their camp. However, a great and general fear spread through Curio's camp, for it was soon increased by the various conversations of men. Everyone formed an opinion of his own, and to what he had heard from others added his own apprehensions. When this had spread from a single author to several persons, and was handed to one another, there appeared to be many authors for such sentiments as this, that it was a civil war, that they were men, and therefore that it was lawful for them to act freely, and follow which party they pleased. These were the legions which a short time before had belonged to the enemy. The custom of offering free towns to those who joined the opposite party had changed my kindness. The harshest expressions of the soldiers in general did not proceed from the Marzi and Pellini, as those which passed in the tents the night before, and some of their fellow soldiers heard them with displeasure. Some additions were also made to them by those who wished to be thought more zealous in their duty. For these reasons, having called a council, Curio began to deliberate on the general welfare. There were some opinions which advised by all means an attempt to be made, and an attack on Varus's camp, for when such sentiments prevailed among the soldiers they thought idleness was improper. In short, they said that it was better bravely to try the hazard of war in a battle than to be deserted and surrounded by their own troops, and forced to submit to the greatest cruelties. There were some who gave their opinion that they ought to withdraw at the third watch to the Cornelian camp, that by a longer interval of time the soldiers might be brought to a proper way of thinking, and also that if any misfortune should befall them, they might have a safer and readier retreat to Sicily from the great number of their ships. Curio, censuring both measures, said that the one was as deficient in spirit as the other exceeded in it, that the latter advised a shameful flight, and the former recommended them to engage at a great disadvantage. For, he asked, on what could we rely that we could storm a camp, fortified both by nature and art? Or indeed, what advantage would we gain if we gave over the assault, after having suffered considerable loss, as if success did not acquire for a general the affection of an army, and misfortune their hatred? But what did a change of camp imply but a shameful flight, and universal despair, and the alienation of the army? Neither should the obedient suspect that they are distrusted, nor the insolent know that we fear them, because our fears augment the licentiousness of the latter, and dismiss the zeal of the former. But if, he said, we were convinced of the truth of the reports of the disaffection of the army, which I indeed am confident are either altogether groundless, or at least less than they're supposed to be, how much better to conceal and hide our suspicions of it than by our conduct confirm it? Should not the defects of an army be as carefully concealed as the wounds in our bodies, lest we should increase the enemy's hopes? But they moreover advise us to set out at midnight, in order, I suppose, that those who attempt to do wrong may have a fairer opportunity, for conduct of this kind is restrained either by shame or fear, to the display of which the night is most averse. Therefore I am neither so rash as to give my opinion that we ought to attack their camp without hopes of succeeding, nor so influenced by fear as to despond. And I imagine that every expedient ought first to be tried, and I am in a great degree confident that I shall form the same opinions as yourselves on this matter. Curio broke up the council. He called the soldiers together and reminded them what advantage I had derived from their zeal at Corfinium, how by their good offices and influence I had brought over a great part of Italy to my interest. Curio said, "All the municipal towns afterward imitated you and your conduct, nor was it without reason that Caesar judged so favorably, and the enemy so harshly of you. For Pompey, though beaten in no engagement, yet was obliged to shift his ground and leave Italy, from the precedent established by your conduct. Caesar committed I, Curio, who he considered his dearest friend, and the provinces of Sicily and Africa, without which he was not able to protect Rome or Italy, to your protection. There are some here who encourage you to revolt from us. What can they wish for more than at once to ruin us, and to involve you in a heinous crime? Or what baser opinions could they in their resentment entertain of you, than that you would betray those who acknowledged themselves indebted to you for everything, and put yourselves in the power of those who think they have been ruined by you? Have you not heard of Caesar's exploits in Spain?" he said, "that he routed two armies, conquered two generals, recovered two provinces, and he effected all this within 40 days after he came in sight of the enemy. Can those who were not able to stand against him while they were uninjured resist him when they are ruined? Will you, who took part with Caesar while victory was uncertain, take part with the conquered enemy when the fortune of war is decided and when you ought to reap the reward of your services? For they say that they have been deserted and betrayed by you, and remind you of a former oath. But did you desert Lucius Domitius, or did Lucius Domitius desert you? Did he not, when you were ready to submit to the greatest difficulties, cast you off? Did he not, without your privacy, endeavor to effect his own escape? When you were betrayed by him, were you not preserved by Caesar's generosity? And how could he think you bound by your oath to him, when after having thrown up the ensigns of power and abdicated his government, he became a private person and a captive in another's power? A new obligation is left upon you, that you should disregard the oath by which you are at present bound, and have respect only to that which was invalidated by the surrender of your general and his diminution of rank. But I suppose, although you are pleased with Caesar, you are offended by me. However, I shall not boast of my services to you, which still are inferior to my own wishes or your expectations. However, soldiers have ever looked for the rewards of labor at the conclusion of a war, and what the issue of it is likely to be, not even you can doubt. But why should I omit to mention my own diligence and good fortune, and to what a happy crisis affairs are now arrived? Are you sorry that I transported the army safe and entire, without the loss of a single ship, that on my arrival in the very first attack I routed the enemy's fleet, that twice in 2 days I defeated the enemy's horse, that I carried out of the very harbor and bay 200 of the enemy's victualers, and reduced them to a situation where they can receive no supplies either by land or sea? Will you divorce yourselves from this fortune and these generals, and prefer the disgrace of Corfinium, the defeat of Italy, the surrender of both Spains, and the prestige of the African war? I, for my part, wished to be called a soldier of Caesar's. You honored me with the title of Imperator. If you repent your bounty, I give it back to you. Restore to me my former name, that you may not appear to have conferred the honor on me as a reproach. The soldiers, being affected by this oration, frequently attempted to interrupt Curio while he was speaking, so that they appeared to bear with excessive anguish the suspicion of treachery, and when he was leaving the assembly they unanimously beseeched him to be of good spirits, and not hesitate to engage the enemy and put their fidelity and courage to a trial. As the wishes and opinions of all were changed by this act, Curio, with the general consent, determined, whenever opportunity offered, to hazard a battle. The next day he led out his forces and arranged them in order of battle on the same ground where they had been posted the preceding day. Nor did Attius Varus hesitate to draw out his men, that if any occasion should offer either to tamper with Curio's men or to engage on equal terms, he might not miss the opportunity. There lay between the two armies a valley, as already mentioned, not very deep, but of a difficult and steep ascent. Each was waiting till the enemy's forces should attempt to pass it, that they might engage with the advantage of the ground. At the same time, on the left wing, the entire cavalry of Publius Accius, and several light-armed infantry intermixed with them, were sighted descending into the valley. Against them Curio detached his cavalry and two cohorts of the Marrucini, whose first charge the enemy's horse were unable to stand, but setting spurs to their horses fled back to their friends. The light infantry, being deserted by those who had come out along with them, were surrounded and cut to pieces by our men. Varus's whole army, facing that way, saw their men flee and cut down, upon which Rebilus, one of my lieutenants who Curio had brought with him from Sicily, knowing that he had great experience in military matters, cried out, "You see, the enemy are daunted, Curio. Why do you hesitate to take advantage of the opportunity?" Curio, having merely expressed that the soldiers should keep in mind the promises which they had made to him the day before, then ordered them to follow him, and ran far ahead of them all. The valley was so difficult of ascent that the foremost men could not struggle up it unless assisted by those behind. But the minds of Attius's soldiers, being prepossessed with fear and the flight and slaughter of their men, never thought of opposing us, and they all imagined that they were already surrounded by our horse, and therefore, before a dart could be thrown, or our men come near them, Varus's whole army turned their backs and retreated to their camp. In this flight, one Fabius, a Pellinian common soldier in Curio's army, pursuing the enemy's rear, with a loud voice shouted to Varus by name and often called him, so that he seemed to be one of his soldiers who wished to speak to him and give him advice. When Varus, after being repeatedly called, stopped and looked at him, and inquired who he was and what he wanted, he made a blow with his sword at his naked shoulder and very nearly killed Varus. But he escaped the danger by raising his shield to ward off the blow. Fabius was surrounded by the soldiers near him and cut to pieces. By the multitude and crowds of those that fled, the gates of the camps were thronged and the passage stopped, and a greater number perished in that place without a stroke than in the battle and flight. Nor were we far from driving them from this camp, and some of them ran straight away to the town without halting. But both the nature of the ground and the strength of the fortifications prevented our access to the camp. Curio's soldiers marching out to battle were without those things which were necessary for storming a camp. Curio, therefore, led his army back to the camp, with all his troops safe except Fabius. Of the enemy, about 600 were killed and 1,000 wounded, all of whom, after Curio's return, and several more, under pretext of their wounds, but in fact through fear, withdrew from the camp into the town, which Varus, perceiving and knowing the terror of his army, leaving a trumpeter in his camp and a few tents for show, at the third watch led back his army quietly into the town. The next day Curio resolved to besiege Utica, and to draw lines about it. In the town there was a multitude of people ignorant of war, owing to the length of the peace, some of them Uticans, very well inclined to me, for my favors to them. The Roman population was composed of persons differing widely in their sentiments. The terror occasioned by former battles was very great, and therefore they openly talked of surrendering, and argued with Attius that he should not suffer the fortune of them all to be ruined by his obstinacy. While these things were in agitation, couriers who had been sent forward arrived from King Juba with the intelligence that he was on the march with considerable forces and encouraged them to protect and defend their city, a circumstance which greatly comforted their despairing hearts. The same intelligence was brought to Curio, but for some time he could not give credit to it, because he had so great confidence in his own good fortune. And at this time my success in Spain was announced in Africa by messages and letters. Being elated by all these things, Curio imagined that the king would not dare to attempt anything against him. But when he found out, from undoubted authority, that Juba's forces were less than 20 miles distant from Utica, abandoning his works, he retired to the Cornelian camp. Here Curio began to lay in corn and wood, and to fortify his camp, and immediately dispatched orders to Sicily that his 2 legions and the remainder of his cavalry should be sent to him. His camp was well adapted for protracting a war, from the nature and strength of the situation, from its proximity to the sea, and the abundance of water and salt, of which a great quantity had been stored up from the neighboring salt pits. Timber could not fail him from the number of trees, nor corn, with which the lands abounded. Therefore, with the general consent, Curio determined to wait for the rest of his forces and protract the war. This plan being settled and his conduct approved of, Curio was informed by some deserters from the town that Juba had stayed behind in his own kingdom, being called home by a neighboring war and a dispute with the people of Leptis, and that Sabura, his commander-in-chief, who had been sent with a small force, was drawing near to Utica. Curio, rashly believing this information, altered his design and resolved to hazard a battle. His youth, his spirits, his former good fortune and confidence of success contributed much to confirm this resolution. Induced by these motives, early in the night he sent all his cavalry to the enemy's camp near the river Bagrada, of which Sabura, of whom we've already spoken, was the commander. But the King Juba was coming after them with all his forces, and was posted at a distance of 6 miles behind Sabura. The horse that was sent performed their march that night, and attacked the enemy unaware and unexpectedly, for the Numidians, after the usual barbarous custom, encamped here and there without any regularity. The cavalry having attacked them, went deep in sleep and dispersed. Curio killed a great number of them. Many were frightened and ran away, after which the horse returned to Curio and brought some prisoners with them. Curio had set out at the fourth watch with all his forces, except 5 cohorts which he left to guard the camp. Having advanced 6 miles, he met the horse, heard what had happened, and asked the captives who commanded the camp at Bagrada. They replied, "Sabura." Through eagerness to perform his journey, he neglected to make further inquiries, but looking back to the company next to him, he said, "Don't you see, soldiers, that the answer of the prisoners corresponds with the account of the deserters? That the king is not with him, that he sent only a small force which was not able to withstand a few horsemen? Hasten then to spoil, to glory, that we may now begin to think of rewarding you and returning you thanks." The achievements of the horse were great in themselves, especially if their small number be compared with the vast host of Numidians. However, the account was enlarged by them, as men are naturally inclined to boast of their own merit. Besides, many spoils were produced. The men and horses that were taken were brought into their sight, that they might imagine that every moment of time which intervened was a delay to their conquest. By this means the hopes of Curio were seconded by the ardor of the soldiers. He ordered the horse to follow him, and hastened his march, that he might attack them as soon as possible, while in consternation after their flight. But the horse, fatigued by the expedition of the preceding night, were not able to keep up with him, and fell behind in different places. Even this did not abate Curio's hopes. Juba, being informed by Sabura of the battle in the night, sent to his relief 2,000 Spanish and Gallic horse, which he was accustomed to keep near him to guard his person, and that part of his infantry on which he had the greatest dependence. And he himself followed slowly after with the rest of his forces and 40 elephants, suspecting that as Curio had sent his horse ahead, he himself would follow them. Sabura drew up his army, both horse and foot, and commanded them to give way gradually and retreat through the pretense of fear, that when it was necessary he would give them the signal for battle, and such orders as he found circumstances required. Curio, as his idea of their present behavior was calculated to confirm his former hopes, imagined that the enemy were running away, and led his army from the rising grounds down to the plain. When he had advanced from this place about 16 miles, his army being exhausted with the fatigue, he halted. Sabura gave his men the signal, marshaled his army, and began to go around his ranks and encourage them. But he made use of the foot only for show, and sent the horsemen to the charge. Curio was not deficient in skill, and encouraged his men to rest all their hopes in their valor. Neither were the soldiers, though wearied, nor the horse, though few, and exhausted with fatigue, deficient in ardor to engage, nor in courage, but the latter were in number but 200. The rest had dropped behind on the march. Wherever they charged, they forced the enemy to give ground, but they were not able to pursue them far when they fled, or to press their horses too severely. Besides, The enemy's cavalry began to surround us on both wings and trample down our rear. When any cohorts ran forward out of the line, the Numidians, being fresh, by their speed avoided our charge and surrounded ours when they attempted to return to their post and cut them off from the main body. So it did not appear safe either to keep their ground and maintain their ranks.